I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, a conversation with the distinguished political scientist Robert Putnam and the social entrepreneur Shailene Romney Garrett about their new book, which explores patterns in the realms of economics, politics, society, and culture to assert that the division and polarity that dominate today's political discourse does not have to continue unabated. The book doesn't just suggest a hopeful hypothesis for a divided electorate. It's a trenchant analysis of how and why we are where we are. It's called The Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take any new calls or online comments today. Robert Putnam and Shailene Romney Garrett join me after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you're with us today. In 1961, President John F. Kennedy implored Americans to ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. 20 years later, Ronald Reagan won election by asking Americans, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Not if the country was better off, if you were better off. In a fascinating, compelling, and wholly original new book, the political scientist Robert Putnam and the social entrepreneur Shailene Romney Garrett assert that from the Gilded Age of the late 19th century to the present moment, America has oscillated between a society framed by colossal income inequality and political polarization to a more progressive notion of concern for the common good and political cooperation. Putnam and Romney Garrett observe that following the inequality and political polarity of the Gilded Age, a decades-long era began in which Americans embraced the need for cooperation to confront the existential challenges of an economic catastrophe in the 1930s and a world war in the 1940s, and civil rights legislation and safety net programs in the 1960s. But then the tide shifted and deep polarity returned. Two scholars who are quoted in their new book note that political rivalry can devolve into partisan hatred, and that losing has somehow ceased to be an accepted part of the political process. Instead, it's become a catastrophe. As the Trump administration comes to a close, the factions of the electorate remain separated by a wide, gaping hole. Can President-elect Joe Biden's aspiration of uniting the country be achieved in this climate? Well, my two guests today make the case that it can. Their book is called The Upswing: How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. Robert Putnam and Shailene Romney Garrett join me on Zoom. Welcome to you both.
Thanks very much, Tom. It's good to be back with you and your audience. We're looking forward to this very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, I am too. And Bob, it's, your book 20 years ago now, Bowling Alone, was an incredibly influential book. And I had the great pleasure of discussing it with you and working on projects related to it over the years. But I have to tell you both that this book, this new one, The Upswing, is an incredibly important, compelling, and wonderful book. So thank you very much for it. I was just blown away by it, and I recommend it to our listeners very highly. You quote the mathematician and philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, who said, seek simplicity and distrust it. And I love that quote. So Bob, let me ask you to do just that at the risk of oversimplification. Talk about this inverted U that sort of charts the last 100 and so years of American history and what your central thesis is.
Shailene and I will do that together. I'll get started, Shailene, and then you can follow up. Basically, we rely on quite hard statistical evidence to show that if we begin the film about 125 years ago, at the end of the 19th century, and run it forward, there's one long inverted U curve, which is on the cover of the book, in which At the beginning of that period, America was very, very unequal and very politically polarized and very socially isolated and very culturally self-centered, individualistic. And then you can see in all these charts, dozens of charts in the book, you can see that beginning around 1900 or 1910, America begins to shift in a better direction, not instantly reaching economic equality, of course, but we begin to move away from extreme inequality and toward more equality. And similarly, away from extreme polarization and toward somewhat more bipartisanship and cooperation across the aisle, away from extreme isolation and toward a little more connectedness with our family and friends and community institutions, and from this extreme cultural self-centeredness toward a greater sense that we're sort of all in this together. And then things are getting better all the time. I don't mean we're in a perfect society, but by the middle or late 1960s, America is, I repeat, far from equal, but more equal than it has been in a long time, less polarized, less socially isolated, and more focused on the things we have in common than the things that divide us. And then there's a sharp pivot, and the last 50 years, speaking now from 2020, the last 50 years, we've been through growing inequality, growing polarization, growing social isolation, growing individualism, and we end back where we began. That is, we're now just about as unequal and polarized and isolated and individualistic as we were at the end of the Gilded Age. Shailen, why don't you take the story from there? Because we want to draw some lessons from that parallelism.
Yeah, one thing that we like to emphasize here is that the lesson of this book and the argument of the book is not that we should return to some supposed golden age, you know, when we were at the peak of this inverted U-curve. Certainly that was a time when we had come closer to equality and cohesion than ever before, but it was by no means a perfect high point in American history, right? So the lessons of the book really look back to a time that was remarkably similar to where we are today, namely the last Gilded Age. By statistical measures, it was breathtakingly similar, as well as through the historical narrative, we learn how very similar that time was to where we are today. So the question becomes then, how did we get up out of it? There were commentators decrying the end of democracy at that time, just as, you know, we hear today. Is this the end of the American experiment? Have we failed, right? The same thing was being said then, and yet it didn't fail. It managed to pull itself up. So how? I mean, and the book focuses on these lessons. Well, first of all, it turns out that addressing economic inequality was a lagging indicator. So a lot of times people think, oh, well, we must have figured out a way to fix the economic inequality, and then the cultural narcissism changed and the polarization changed. And that actually turns out surprisingly not to be the case. As Bob likes to say, it seems that economics is more the caboose, not the engine of this upswing. So what was the engine? Well, when you pair the statistical data with the historical record, what starts to emerge as a picture of a moral awakening that really began to happen in the Gilded Age. People began to reconsider their primary conceptions, the ideas about what this society was really about. The Gilded Age was a time that was characterized by social Darwinism, this dog-eat-dog society is one giant competition, to the social gospel. This sense of moral indignation, not just directed outward, but directed inward. People asking themselves how they had been complicit in creating this deeply unequal, deeply polarized society. So there were a concerned group of reformers who reformed themselves, essentially, reformed their own hearts, and then took that reformation out into the world. Many of them were extraordinarily young. This was the Progressive Era, which came on the heels of the Gilded Age, was a youth-driven movement. Most of the progressives who were leading this charge were under the age of 30 when they were doing their most important work. And what were they doing? They were translating their outrage and moral awakening into citizen engagement. They were reclaiming individual agency in the face of drift and dizzying complexity in their society. And they were really finding innovative solutions to local problems that transcended a gridlocked left-right framework. Ultimately, they created a vast upswell of citizen innovation that was then met with top-down strategies to turn those into national programs. And, you know, a couple of other things that we see from this period is that charismatic political leadership also was lagging. We tend to look at the progressive era and think of Teddy Roosevelt and the Square Deal, but he didn't really articulate that until more like 1912, on sort of the tail end. He was someone who came along and built upon the vast coalition that these local reformers had built. So, you know, the charismatic political leader wasn't the hero then. He was somebody that built on the work that citizens had done. So if we want to create another upswing today, we might look at some of these strategic lessons and ask ourselves if we could recreate some of this today. And the other thing that we need to note, of course, that in lauding the progressives of the progressive era, the we that they were seeking, the we that they started to build toward, was certainly not inclusive enough. There was a lot of racism knit into the programs and the ideas that they were working with. And so today, of course, we have to take full inclusion as our starting point of any kind of new upswing. But can we build a youth-driven movement, a moral-driven movement, a movement that's about citizen innovation? I think we can, and that's the lesson of this book.
That's Shailene Romney Garrett. She, along with Robert Putnam, are the authors of a terrific new book called The Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. So, Bob Putnam, you say that when you measure these areas, economics, politics, society, culture, and as Shailene mentioned, you also have a chapter devoted to race and one devoted to gender, and you measure them over this unusually long period of time, that you can detect and investigate things that were previously unnoticed, patterns that we didn't pick up before. So tell us what kinds of things you noticed in looking at it in this prism that perhaps folks before you doing this kind of work didn't notice.
Well, that's right, Tom. And let me say, I think our contribution, much of what we say, much of the individual charts that appear in the book, in fact, most of them are known to specialists in the field. But there are two ways in which we've widened the focus. First of all, we've widened it to look simultaneously at economics and politics and society and culture. So economists tend to know about the trends in the economy. Political scientists certainly know about polarization, you know, and sociologists know about trends, recent trends in society and so on. But we've sort of pulled these together, and it turns out they're all the same graph. They're all the same inverted U-shaped curve, what we have come to call the I curve. And so I think it's striking when you see that all of these different parts of American society were moving more or less in a synchronized single curve that, you know, that covered 125 years. And that's the second, I think, contribution that we made, which is to look at the whole of the curve and not just the last half of the curve. Take any one of these curves. The last half is well known to people. I mean, for example, that we show that there's an extreme polarization happening that's been happening in America for the last 50 years. Well, that's hardly news. You just pick up the newspaper. There is one bit of news, actually, I think one thing that you can get from that last, even if you know about polarization. Donald Trump did not cause this trend. Donald Trump was not the source of all our problems. Donald Trump comes into the story very late. I do not mean that he's blaming us or that I think he's great for America. I don't mean that at all. I'm trying to say this deeper trend predated him. He didn't. And what follows from that is getting rid of Donald Trump will not solve the problem. We still have to go much deeper to begin to address this deeper trend. So I was saying, you can see in the political sphere, you can see it's that the polarization is not just now, but that this whole period, you can see when we were becoming less polarized. That's the whole first more than half of the 20th century, from roughly 1910 to roughly 1965. We're getting less polarized during that period. And I think a lot of people don't know that. And similarly, we were becoming less unequal, or we were becoming more equal. And I think people might find it interesting to notice, my goodness, there was a period where America was actually moving in the right direction in terms of economic equality. And similarly, with respect to the social and the cultural trends, finding the data was a big, as you say, is a challenge. It's easy to get data, you know, going back, you know, maybe 50 years, that's pretty easy. And Bowling Alone, we did a lot of that. But going back 125 years required us to do a lot of digging deep into historical sources, because we didn't want to just be telling a story, or rather we wanted to tell a story, but we wanted to be sure it actually fit the objective evidence. And therefore we had to look really hard to find hard, measurable indicators of these trends.
And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about what some of those trends are. Robert Putnam and Shailene Romney Garrett, their new book is called The Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. We will continue our conversation after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, this is an archive edition of our program. My guests are Robert Putnam of Harvard University and the social entrepreneur Shailene Romney Garrett. They are the authors of a terrific and important new book, The Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. Because our program was recorded earlier, we can't take any new calls or comments today. So, Shailene, you mentioned that the we in this I curve was certainly in the main white and male. You also say that you hoped that the book will bridge the OK Boomer generational divide. And towards the end of the book, you say that politics... you can't argue that politics is the key to this curve, this inverted U. You also say it's neither millennials or Twitter or Facebook. You can't blame all that because the decline in equality predated those things by a long time. So by bridging the OK Boomer generational divide, what do you mean exactly, and how does that inform the data you've collected in this book?
Sure. So, you know, there's been a lot of books written in the last 10 years about how we got here, right? How did we get into this mess? It's sort of become its own genre of book, right? Yeah. And a lot of these books focus on the downturn from where we were at mid-century in the 1960s, right? And so I think there is a sense that there is this boomer nostalgia for an America gone by, right? In a way, this is the Make America Great Again thesis, right? And this is hard for people my age. I'm a Gen Xer, on the line with being a millennial. And, you know, we've only known an America in decline. As Bob said, all of these trends within living memory were going in a positive direction, but those of us my age don't remember that. And so there is a bit of a despair, I think, amongst young people saying, you know, things are just getting worse and worse and worse, and they're just going to keep getting worse and worse and worse. And how is it possible that we could possibly change anything? And I think there's a tendency to sort of blame the boomers that young people have. The question here, though, again, is not how do we go back to some supposed golden age? That isn't what we want to motivate young people to do, because that isn't a very motivating project when you look back on a supposed peak in American history that was highly racialized, right? We agree that we shouldn't try to motivate people to go back in history. We need to go forward in history. But what we need to do is look back to a time in history where we could learn some strategic lessons for how we might be able to move forward in a way that we've done once before. So there's a hope in the sense that this is possible. It's possible to turn this around. The youth of the Gilded Age felt the same way that youth feel today. And they managed to take the reins of history, to grab hold of their own agency as citizens, and to turn things around. Young people today can do that as well. And they can create an America in the image that motivates them, not in the image of some supposed golden age that the boomers look back upon as some kind of thing that we should recreate.
Yeah, and Bob Putnam, you know, there was some evidence of that, certainly through the primary process and the election, certainly through the demonstrations for racial equality that flooded the streets over the summer following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. When you chart what you call the great convergence and the great divergence, again, this demarcation line of when it starts to decline is in the mid-1960s. What was the, is there a particular precipitating thing that caused the decline? Was it the Vietnam War? I mean, obviously there isn't a specific thing because you've written a whole book about all the things, but how is it that, you know, there's this dramatic U-turn from the great convergence to the divergence, you know, sometime around late 60s, early 1970s. Why?
Well, I was chuckling, Tom, because actually that's my generation. I graduated from college in 1963. So for me, writing our chapter on the 60s was a kind of a trip down memory lane. It's important to keep in mind, and of course people who didn't live through it don't know this, and even people who did live through it, this isn't so clear. There were the much of the 60s actually happened in the 70s, if I could put it that way. There was an early 60s period, which was actually the culmination of this more than half a century of things going in the right direction. And it was a period of great weeness at the time. I mean, it was, you know, it was communes and the music, pop music was all about community and so on. And then very sharply about 1964, 65, America turned in a very different direction, really a quite sharp pivot. And if you talk to different people, we've talked to a lot of folks, and I've talked to a lot of people my own age, and everybody has a different idea about what really caused it. If you talk to people, the oldest folks still around are very likely to refer to the assassination of first of all, Jack Kennedy, and then Martin Luther King, and then Bobby Kennedy, and so on. And the people a little younger than that are likely to talk about Vietnam. Other people will talk about student upheavals, that is just because there were so many kids in college, the boomers were just entering college, and they were, you know, they were quite apart from anything else, they were frustrated about the education they were getting. And then there was the civil rights movement. And then more or less separately from that, there were urban riots and kind of, and the move, the pill and the sexual revolution, probably the greatest change in sexual mores in American history. That happened in just a couple of years. And then the women's movement and the epidemic of drugs and Nixon and Watergate and, you know, stagflation and the oil embargoes and so on. Those were essentially all individually unrelated. In memory, we compress them all together because they all happened so quickly. But the bottom line is we don't think there's any single cause of the reversal. Probably the closest to being a leading factor at that in that pivot point was, in fact, white backlash against the civil rights movement. In a way, this leads into your question about the Black Lives Matter movement and other events that have happened actually since we wrote the book. It's important for us to make clear. This book was written and finished and off at the publishers last January, and it was written without knowing anything that was going to happen that has in fact happened since the pandemic and the, you know, and the economic downturn and the Black Lives Matter movement and so on. We didn't write with that in mind, although it turns out, actually, that a lot of what's happened can be, I think, pretty readily interpreted in terms of our, in terms of the framework that we offered. Yeah. Shailen, you may want to say something about the issue of race, because,
that is where I think we need to take our conversation next, because you write that the party polarization between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party begins with race. and it's this constant central conflict. But it soon became more about more than just race. And I wondered, in what ways did it spread out from race? How was race so central to it? And then, for example, you talk about split ticket voting. And 40 years ago, members of Congress were very much pressured by both sides of the political spectrum. Now everybody lives in these gerrymandered districts, and there is no pressure from the opposing political party. But there did seem to be some split ticket voting in this last election in November, in which Republican senators were elected or reelected in states that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris won. So talk about the centrality of race and how it mushroomed out of that.
Sure. So when Bob mentions the white backlash against the civil rights movement, what became clear is that when you look at the survey data, you know, Americans were really in favor, largely in favor of the Civil Rights Acts, but that they were in favor of it in principle, right? So when it came time to then implement programs that made more of an equal playing field, that maybe, you know, measures for integration, that sort of a thing, people were much less in favor of that. They actually wanted the Johnson administration to slow down in implementing integration. And, you know, when you look at the Kerner Commission, which was created by President Johnson in 1968 as a way to investigate what happened with these urban riots, what caused the urban riots, which is, you know, a familiar conversation about what we're having today, right? What caused the unrest in the cities? What they found was that the clear cause was the ghettoization of Black Americans and the immense frustration of being stuck in this position they couldn't get out of, right? And that was the cause. And the Kerner Commission recommended all sorts of programs to change the facts on the ground. And Johnson himself, who had championed the Civil Rights Acts, backed off of those recommendations, basically indicating that he was, you know, his sort of fine-tuned political sensibilities were detecting this sea change in white attitudes. And what we see that what followed after that was sort of a parade of politicians recognizing that if they could sort of play on that white backlash, they could make serious political gains. And so there is this cynicism introduced into politics where it's like, oh, you know, we can exploit this racial realignment for political gain. And that plays out, you know, over time. And then you start to see people simultaneously beginning to vote a straight ticket. Whereas before, you know, in the mid-century era, people might vote for a candidate of one party for one office, and they might vote for a candidate of a different party for a different office. And we start to see people then, the emergence of this idea of tribalism, right? That there's one political team that I'm on, and I don't vote for the other team. And, you know, we've yet to see what the meaning of the split ticket voting that's happened in the last election really means. I mean, does it, Donald Trump is such a character in a sense, right? So many people, I think, were repudiating him personally. Is that a sign of bipartisanship? Because in many ways, right, split ticket voting is a measure of bipartisanship. It's a measure of the opposite of political polarization, something we call in the book political comedy, right? Is the split ticket phenomenon that we saw in the most recent election an indicator that we're moving into a less polarized moment? I don't know. To me, it seems like more that was a personal repudiation of Trump and less a movement toward, you know, a more bipartisan moment.
Mm-hmm. Tom, I know you'll want to get to questions from your visitors, and I don't want to interrupt that very much, except to say one more thing that goes back to the Kerner Commission. The Kerner Commission seemed at the time as if it was a signal that America was finally coming to terms with its long history of incredible oppression of Black people. So it seemed at the time as if, you know, we were going to begin making progress. But the fact of the matter is, America, in terms of hard measures of Black-white equality, that is income and wealth and health and a whole range of hard measures of Black-white equality, fundamentally, Blacks have made, America has made zero progress toward greater equality in the whole last half century. Zero progress. Whites think, because whites don't know the conditions in black communities, whites think, well, you know, Martin Luther King, we passed the civil rights and everything, blacks ought to be happy. Blacks know the facts, which is black people in real terms, black white equality has actually slightly worsened in the last 50 years. And that was what was happening in the Black Lives Matter movement this summer. Of course, part of it was about police killings of black men, but the underlying driver of that of the Black Lives Matter movement this summer was in fact that blacks know, and most whites don't know, that there's been zero progress toward greater racial equality in the last 50 years.
Yeah, there's absolutely a tendency for all sorts of folks, white people, to say, oh, look at how much progress we've made. We elected a black president, and, you know, we've got black CEOs, and we've got, you know, black celebrities, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, you present data that says basically as of 1965, I mean, you got the Voting Rights Act in 65, you got the Civil Rights Act in 64, you have things like Medicare and Medicaid, even the National Endowment for the Arts, all of that happens in the mid-1960s. And then after that, nothing happens. You also make the point that you find it under-recognized that there was considerable progress towards equality for many years leading up to 1965, that it wasn't just Dr. King and the movement in the early 60s, that it preceded that. So I want to talk to you about that after we remind folks the name of the book and go to one caller that we have. The book is called The Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. The authors are Bob Putnam and Shaylin Romney Garrett, who are my guests today here on Midday. Let's go to the phones to Jim, who's calling from Towson. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. We just said something about voting a straight ticket, and I thought to myself, this simply means that we're really uncritical in our thinking. We're the product of a weak education system where we lack, as students, discipline. My mother told me this in 1945. You American students don't have discipline. She came from Greece where having a high school education was equivalent to 2 years of our college. So basically, we're uncritical and self-centered. We're a different animal than we were 50 to 75 years ago. We can barely tell the difference between blue and yellow. Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow and writers like Mary McGrory of the Evening Star, where I worked with Bernstein in 1963, would not be able to connect with us today.
All right. Well, thanks for that comment, Jim. And again, Bob Putnam, Jim is basically giving some of the thesis of your book. We also have an email from Ronnie who says, with regard to citizens who fall into this individualistic Trump-supporting population, there is the privilege of getting to craft your own false reality. Racism isn't systemic. Science isn't real. Coronavirus is a conspiracy. I'm curious how this idea of people choosing to live in their beliefs rather than evidenced reality ties in to this lack of unity and connectedness as a population. Shaylin, you want to take that one, or Bob?
Sure. You know, I think it's a great point. I think part of what's going on here is that we have vast technological industries that have facilitated these information siloing, right? And a lot of times, again, we despair that what can possibly be done about this. But again, looking at this period of the early 20th century, we saw similar and analog in the sense the industries were different, but they were exploitative. They had taken over people's lives. There was a sense that that agency had been lost. We're talking about the railroads and the oil and gas industries and things like that. And we as a citizenry came together and said, enough, we've got to reshape these industries such that they are pro-social and pro-civic. I think that we can do the same thing again with our information systems that are creating silos. However, there's also a lot of choice to that. There's choice in how we construct these industries, but there's also choice in how we consume social media and consume news. And, you know, again, I go back to the words of a social gospeler, one of these reformers from the Progressive Era, who said, you know, it's a mistake to think that if we make some, you know, change to our politics, that will bring us peace. We have to have a different kind of men and women. men and women for whom duties are more than rights and service dearer than privilege. And that goes back to the comment that was made by your caller that, like, you know, we tend to think of education these days as a right. It's not a responsibility as citizens to educate ourselves on both sides of the issues. We do have the privilege of siloing, but that's a choice. And if there's one message of this book, it's that as citizens, we have agency and we can use that agency in more selfish or more selfless ways. And this is why, you know, it's really fascinating that what we saw on the front end of the last upswing was a real moral awakening. It was a mental and spiritual revolution in which people began to realize that they had to take responsibility for their behavior because their behavior was creating the society that they were seeing around them. I think that's true today as well.
It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guests are Robert Putnam and Shailene Romney Garrett. We are talking about their new book, The Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. We will continue our conversation after a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. 20 years ago, the political scientist Robert Putnam of Harvard University published a best-selling and influential book called Bowling Alone. It examined how America was losing what Putnam called social capital, the bonds that develop between people who are invested in civic and social life. And as those bonds deteriorate, so does democracy itself. In his latest book, written with the social entrepreneur Shailene Romney Garrett, Putnam charts the course of the last 125 years of American history to discover parallels between times when we experienced the kind of political polarization we are enveloped in now, as well as those moments in which we were united in common purpose. Robert Putnam and Shailene Romney Garrett are my guests today until the top of the hour. The book is called The Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. So, Bob Putnam, at the end of this book, you say, What is the proper balance between guarding the interests, rights, and autonomy of the individual on the one hand and maintaining a strong sense of unity, shared purpose, and common destiny on the other? So let me give you an opportunity to answer your own question.
Well, thanks, Tom. I guess I would say first, it's not that we think that the perfect world is a purely communitarian world. That is, we think that there are definite advantages and moral advantages to some emphasis on individual liberties. And indeed, Tocqueville, who's often thought of as the patron saint of communitarianism, of an emphasis on community, also invented the word individualism. And he was aware that you had to kind of strike some kind of balance. He called it self-interest rightly understood. But whatever you think about the proper balance between individualism and collect and the community, we're clearly way out of balance right now. And so our hope is that this book will encourage people to think about, first of all, how we got into this mess. Everybody on all sides agrees we're in a mess. And so we're partly trying to say, look, this is how we got into this mess. And then secondly, to think, well, wouldn't it be better if we could move a little bit more in the direction of an emphasis on what we have in common, a we direction toward a we, not an all white male we, of course, we're very clear about that, but a little more in the direction of a sense that we're all in this together and away from this sense, which frankly, the past administration, it's nice to call it that, the Trump administration, really constantly emphasize that we're not all in this together and we're only out for one another and we should only be out for one another. I'm actually quite hopeful that we can move in that direction, although, of course, it's not going to happen overnight. It didn't happen overnight the last time we went through this.
We have an email from Susan who says, it sounds like a great book. I can't wait to read it. I am a white middle-aged woman who's amazed at the patience that's been shown by my black fellow citizens over the decades. I see reasons for great optimism in the coming years. So Susan, I guess, agrees with you, Bob. We have another emailer, David, who says, my perception is that the left proceeds by fits and starts, symbolic victories and expectations of revolution, while the right has proceeded for 60 years with careful, disciplined work on the scene and behind the scenes to achieve the hold on power they now enjoy. So Shaylin, what do you think strategically about how the movement for a more progressive notion of, you know, political comity is being achieved? I mean, we have a Democratic primary that had at one point nearly 30 candidates, and certainly the biggest centrist in the bunch was the one that ended up prevailing, and then he won the election pretty handily. So is progressivism itself to be defined, you know, only as the sort of far left? I mean, I think when people hear the term progressive now, they think of it as very much to the left of the political spectrum. What do you think about, you know, strategically how the Democratic Party, which is the home of progressives, are proceeding?
You know, I think that oftentimes what we see on the left is a little bit of a war of the we's, right? Of which issue is going to take precedence? Which is the first most important thing that we have to address? And I think what's missing on the left is a zooming out and a finding of the unifying threads for what kind of vision of society we're really moving toward, right? And so I think there is hope in the fact that Biden prevailed, and there's hope that he can help us find those unifying threads. And I think something to remember about the early 20th century progressive movement, and again, the word progressive as it was used back then is different than it's used today. Today it is used to describe that left end of the political spectrum. But back then, you know, in 1912, all three political candidates identified as progressive. They were sort of jockeying for who's going to win the title of being the most progressive presidential candidate. But this early 20th century progressive movement was a diverse coalition of often conflicting factions, ranging from socialists to reformist captains of industry. And so all successful reform movements are internally heterogeneous, right? And if they're going to see fundamental long-term change, I think that the new administration should avoid, you know, a false choice between the sort of AOC end of the party on the one hand and the swing district moderates on the other. Like, we have to actually, the left, you know, we believe that the left really must find a way to bring all of those under a big tent, to find the narrative that unites so that we can move forward rather than succumbing to this internal battle of which wing of the party is going to, you know, take precedence.
Yeah, and Bob Putnam, in your last chapter, you list just many of the things that progressive reformers did achieve over the time period in which your book takes place: the secret ballot, the direct primary system, the popular election of senators, women's suffrage, new forms of municipal administration, a federal income tax, a federal reserve system, and the list goes on and on. But you also say that progressives, you know, themselves really are not united around one particular political philosophy other than the embrace of community. Is that going to be enough? And do you think that we have the capacity to get closer to a consensus about progressivism being a good thing? Because right now it doesn't seem like, it seems that, you know, perhaps roughly half of the country doesn't think that progressivism is the way we should be going.
Well, there's a lot there to unpack, Tom. The first thing I would say is that the absence of polarization, that is a sense of bipartisanship and so on, doesn't mean that there's no disagreement. Even at the peak of weeness in America, what we think is the peak of weeness in America in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, there was a lot of disagreement. So we're not arguing for let's not have any disagreement. And in fact, even in the progressive era, there was a lot of divergence. There were people in the progressive era who were sort of like, if I can make it simplistic a little bit, sort of like AOC. And there were people in the progressive era who were you know, basically, and progressives, I mean, they were part of this very broad movement who were, you know, a little bit more like folks today from Wall Street. And they disagreed on a ton, but they agreed on a couple of things. They agreed that where we were then was not where we needed to be. And they agreed to disagree on a lot of factors, on a lot of key issues. And so the first thing I would say is, I think that the future that faces the Biden administration, whether or not the seats in Georgia go to the Republicans or the Democrats, it will be a contentious period within the Democratic Party, and that's, I would say, normal. Normal in a functioning democracy. So I don't think people should look with horror on the fact that there's going to be disagreement among Democrats. That's exactly the way it worked the last time, and we made it work. I guess the second thing I would want to say about that earlier period, and Shailene alluded to this before, but it's really important. It's probably the single key message of our book. It is that we have agency. And what that means, that sounds very, you know, academic. What that means is we're not the victims of history. And the evidence of that, both the quantitative and the qualitative evidence in the book, I think is quite clear. But we've gotten ourselves into this this view that we're, you know, we can't do anything about history, and that we're the victims, whether if it's in the internet, that we're the victims of technology, or if it's in the political sphere, we're the victims of what we've inherited from the past. And that is simply not true. We want to say, especially to young people today, who've never experienced it from a world differently from the one that we're in, this terrible situation that we're in, it doesn't have to be like that. It can be different. People just like you and facing exactly the same challenges, precisely the same challenges that you are. Change direction.
As Shailene was saying, agency. Sally's on the line. Sally, I want to give you 10 seconds to ask your very good question. We're going to give Shailene just a less than a minute to answer it, and then we're going to have to call it a day. What's on your mind?
I guess, well, thanks. I just wanted to ask the authors to speak to one thing that I'm going to be able to agree with, and a rightist sort of opposition, because I'm definitely the progressive camp, that bases its whole ethos, its entire platform on individualism and the deification of individualism that culminated in the notion that nobody should wear masks. I mean, I don't think that the issue here is more discussion, I think, unless it's about why that's a ridiculous position to be in.
Yeah, Shailene, what do you think? If someone is opposed to unity, how do you have that conversation?
Well, that's something I think about every day, because I live in a part of the country where there is a strong anti-mask movement. I just have to come back to reminding people of what Bob mentioned earlier, Tocqueville's notion of self-interest rightly understood. It's not that we need to surrender self-interest entirely. We need to understand, however, that working together and developing a we is actually in all of our best interest. I think the pandemic is a very vivid depiction of what that means. The more that we can think about others, the more that we all benefit, and that is what a we can look like without surrendering.
Well, on that statement, we're going to call it a day. I very much appreciate it. Robert Putnam and Shailene Romney Garrett. The book is called The Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. Thanks to you both, and good luck with the book. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening to this archive edition of Midday. We hope you'll subscribe to our podcast. You can check us out online, wypr.org/midday. You can follow us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. Thanks for listening. Let's talk again tomorrow.